Daniel, Chapter 6. The eighth talk in a series on Daniel was presented by David Crabtree on June 7, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 8, Daniel, Chapter 6, accompanies this talk.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Reformation Fellowship online version. We'll be looking at Daniel chapter 6 today. Where we left off in the last chapter is the Persians came and they conquered Babylon and took over the Babylonian Empire. So the Babylonian Empire fell in 539 BC. And the Medo-Persian Empire took over that area and controlled it and created their own empire, which eventually became bigger than that of the Babylonians had established. There was historically, according to the sources that we have available to us, there appeared to have been a great deal of internal dissension within Babylon when it was taken over by the Medes and the Persians. And that seemed to be helpful to the Persians. It made it easier for them to take control of the empire. So it turned out to be a relatively, it's not blood-free. There were people killed, but it was not as bloody as you would probably have thought. I have in my notes that it was a relatively friendly takeover, and that may be misleading to call it a friendly takeover, but there were some Babylonians that actually greeted the Persians as they came in and welcomed them. A lot of that was due to the fact that there was religious dissent within the Babylonian Empire. If you'll recall Nabonidus, he primarily worshipped the moon god Sin rather than the traditional god of Babylon, Marduk. And that apparently alienated the priesthood and a number of the citizens of Babylon, of the city of Babylon, from Nabonidus. So there seems to have been a rift within Babylonian society, at least along religious lines. And it, apparently there were other divisions within the Babylonian society as well. All of that made it much easier for the Persians to move in. So they came in, I don't remember if I mentioned last week, they diverted the river that ran right down underneath the walls and through the city of Babylon and out the other side. They diverted the river and walked through on the riverbed. And they came in and took control, and we know that they put Belshazzar to death. Nabonidus, his father, was taken captive, and interestingly, Cyrus gave him, instead of killing him, Cyrus gave him a little area, someplace within the Persian Empire to rule over as king. It was a small area, but he ruled over that for the rest of his life. Curious little historical fact. Cyrus then, having taken over Babylon, he carried out a propaganda campaign claiming that he came at Marduk's bidding, and that Marduk had asked him to come in and conquer Babylon, and he had done so with Marduk's help. all helping him to gain the favor of the people of Babylon, especially those who worship Marduk. So the Persians took over, and we have a whole new empire then controlling much of the ancient Near East. But as we'll see in this chapter, not a lot had changed. There was a new empire, a new people group in control, but a lot the same. Interestingly, Daniel was old at this point in time. If you'll recall, he was 14 years old, probably, in 605 when he came to Babylon. He was entered into this training program that lasted for 3 years. After those 3 years, he entered into state service. In all likelihood, he remained in state service throughout his life in the Babylonian Empire until the fall of the Babylonian Empire. It would appear that he was not a high-ranking official under Belshazzar, because Belshazzar seemed to have a not great familiarity with Daniel. He had some familiarity and knew of Daniel, obviously, but not a close connection with Daniel. So apparently, under Belshazzar, Daniel did not have a high-ranking official, but probably it was in some other capacity within the administration. But he was there for 70 years. So he came with the first deportation. He was there through the fall of Babylon. And that period of time was 70 years. So you add that to the 14 years old that he was when he came. So he's at least 84 years old at the time that Babylon falls. And I'll point it out now, I may mention it later again, but he never goes back to Israel. He spends, from the age of 14 on, he spends his life in Babylon. Now, a quick comment before we start the chapter on the name of the emperor. It refers to him as Darius, or Darius the Mede. I've heard Darius, I don't know which is the best English pronunciation. I'll probably go back and forth. In our chapter, it refers to him as Darius the Mede. Who is he? And there's a lot of confusion because it's just not clear. There are a number of references to Darius the Mede here in this text, and apparently there are a few extra biblical references, but there are a lot of references to Cyrus the Persian. But there are many factors about their lives that are the same. They become the ruler in Babylon, both of them, in 539. And I don't remember all. There are a number of facts that are the same about both of them. A lot of people assume that they are two different individuals. Last week I talked about Gobryas, who apparently was the Babylonian who left Babylon, went over to the Medes and Persians and helped them in their conquest of Babylonia. Some people think he is Darius the Mede. But D.J. Weissman wrote an essay on this topic. He wrote a biography of Nebuchadnezzar that's highly respected. He's a scholar who's worked on this a great deal. He argues that Darius the Mede is the same person as Cyrus the Persian. He points out that Darius the Mede is a name that's only used the first year after the conquering of Babylon. So for the first year after Babylon is conquered, this person goes by Darius the Mede. And we know that Cyrus was first king of the Medes and only later became king of the Persians. But later on, Darius the Mede is dropped as a title, and Cyrus the Persian is the one that is used. The last verse of this chapter, according to Weissman, therefore, could be translated, "So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius," that is, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So the last verse of this chapter, according to Weissman, is actually clarifying that it's one and the same person. I'm assuming that that equation is correct. I'm assuming that Cyrus and Darius, the Mede, those are the same person, and I'm proceeding accordingly. I'll just point out, at the time that the Persians took over Babylon, Cyrus was 62 years old. There's one commentary that I read that talks about the incident that happens in chapter 6, and we'll get to it, but Cyrus was tricked, and this commentator says that it's because Cyrus was an inexperienced ruler. That's not true. Cyrus has been ruling for, I don't remember, I think it's about 40 years. He ruled first over the Persians, then over the Persians and the Medes, and then over the Persians, Medes, and Lydians. And all of that happened years before they took control of he took control of Babylon. So he's been ruling for a long time. He just hasn't been ruling Babylon for a long time. It could be argued that he had inexperience dealing with Babylonian administrators or something like that. That would be true, but he's been ruling for quite some time. All right, let's look at the incident that's described in chapter 6 of Daniel. I'll read the first five verses. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So Daniel continues to enjoy favor, the favor of the emperor. It's a new emperor, but he continues to enjoy the favor of the emperor after this change, after the Medes and Persians take over Babylon. We have a completely different set of ethnic group that's in control. We have a completely different emperor, but Daniel continued to enjoy the favor of this new emperor over Babylon. He must have been very competent, and that must have been obvious to people that interacted with him. He also seems to have been likable, and that can't be bad for someone in that kind of position. Cyrus, according to the text, Cyrus is reorganizing the administration of the empire. He has just, I'm guessing, but it would be approximately double the size of his empire. So it would make sense that he would want to reorganize the empire. I know from my study of history that governments have to reform themselves about every 20 years or so. I'm not sure all of the reasons for that. Apparently, things just change enough that you need to conditions within a country. That's in a country that has the same administration. Things change enough that significant alterations in the administration seem to be necessary. And also, the other problem is personnel can get kind of stuck in positions, they stop thinking of ways to solve problems and that sort of thing. They get real wooden and stiff, and so reform seems to be necessary. So not only have the Persians taken over, doubled the size of their empire, but it's very possible that it was time for administrative changes to be made. So Cyrus institutes a completely different approach to empire. And let me explain what I mean by that. Empire, as I'm using the term, is an attempt to create a union of nations. So it's many different kingdoms, all knit together into a union that all keep contributing to one goal, and that is to the wealth of the dominant kingdom, to the wealth and power of the dominant kingdom. So that's what an empire is. That's what it seeks to do. And empire as an organized system to do this started with the Assyrians. Now, there had been kingdoms that became very large before the time of the Assyrians. Kingdoms would become large and powerful and conquer surrounding kingdoms, and they would take wealth from those kingdoms. But what was typically done was they would conquer Kingdom X, and they would say, we want you to send in a certain amount of tribute every year. And Kingdom X would send in tribute the first year and maybe the second year. But after that, they'd start watching. And if they saw any weakness in the dominant kingdom, they wouldn't send in their tribute. If they thought they could get away with it at all, they wouldn't send in their tribute. And so the only option was for the dominant kingdom then to send military expedition to reconquer Kingdom X. And so what happens with the Assyrians is they decide to do it a little bit differently. They decide if we can get that tribute money on a regular basis without having to send in a military expedition every year, that would save everybody a lot of trouble. We wouldn't have to send our army in. They wouldn't have to fight us. It'd be a lot be neater and cleaner. So that's the thinking behind the formation of empire, is it's a more systematic way of collecting that annual tribute in a way that avoids as much military activity as the kingdoms before them had been engaged in. In order to accomplish that, the Assyrians' approach to empire was to use fear and intimidation. The Assyrians, by all account, were brutal. They prided themselves in being brutal. And so they would go in and they would just destroy the countries that they conquered. Not only did they destroy the countries they conquered, but they would take the people that lived there and they would distribute them into other parts of their empire. So the kingdom of Israel was conquered by the Assyrians and incorporated into the Assyrian empire. And the Assyrians took the leading people, anybody that was at all prominent in Israel, and they moved them to other parts of the ancient Near East. And they took peoples from other conquered areas, and they moved them, and some of those they moved into Israel, the northern kingdom. So they moved everything around. And the thinking was, if we destroy these societies, they will be incapable of mounting a rebellion against us. So that was their strategy to empire. The problem that they ran into was it caused the people throughout their empire to be dispirited, just lethargic, just kind of lost their desire to live, to prosper, to do well. Furthermore, it created a lot of chaos. And so the societies just broke down and didn't function. And when societies break down and don't function well, they are not economically productive. So the Assyrians, they solved the problem of having conquered areas rebel against them. And they did that pretty well. But in doing so, they destroyed those local economies and they couldn't produce much to pay much tribute. So all in all, it didn't work very well. And as my advisor in graduate school used to say, force is the most expensive form of social control. Whenever you want to control the people in your society, the last resort, the people, what people ultimately turn to if nothing else is working, is force. But force is expensive. It takes a lot of manpower to ride a herd on an entire society. And that's what the Assyrians discovered. So when the Babylonians overthrew the Assyrian Empire and established their own empire, they used a little different strategy. They still took the leaders from the conquered kingdoms, but they didn't take as many. They didn't take as much of the population from the conquered kingdom. And they would take them, and they, generally speaking, they settled them near the city of Babylon. And they allowed them to live within in their own communities, which allowed them to maintain their social system and their social connections. So like the Judeans, there were some Judeans who were allowed to remain in the southern kingdom. Remember, there were three times that the Babylonians had to come. This kind of control didn't eliminate rebellions completely. There were three times the Babylonians had to come, and each time they deported a number of people. So by the end, they had deported quite a few, quite a large percentage of the Judeans in the southern kingdom, but not all of them. They had left a number. In addition to that, they sent administrators to any conquered kingdom. They would have administrators on site to kind of oversee things and make sure that things were under control and to facilitate the collection of the annual tribute. So the Babylonian system was a little bit more humane. It was a little bit less destructive, but in many respects it was similar and it was still fairly costly. The Persians then come in and they have a different notion of how they should do empire. They decide that they are going to be as lenient as they possibly can to the conquered kingdoms. And they kind of tap into the resentment that had been developed both under the Assyrian empire and under the Babylonian empire. They decide that what they will do is build up a great deal of goodwill from the peoples that they have conquered. And one of the ways they're going to do this is they're going to allow the people who had been colonized around Babylon to go back to their homelands and resettle there and reestablish their traditional society there. And in so doing, they'll be so grateful to the Persians that you won't have rebellions. So it was a much gentler approach to the problem of empire, of how to keep these very disparate kingdoms and people all on the same page, working for the betterment of the Persian Empire. So as a result, the Persians, it worked pretty well. The Persians had a minimum of rebellion certainly in the early years, there are indications that later on that changed, but the Persian Empire lasted a long time. The Persians were, I don't want to overstate the case. The Persians were still brutal. They were a powerful military force. They could do a lot of destruction. But relatively speaking, they had a much gentler approach to solving the problem of empire than did the Babylonians and the Assyrians. And the Jews were beneficiaries of this approach. Under Cyrus, the Jews were allowed to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city and to rebuild the temple. And we'll talk more about that in a couple of chapters. As I was thinking about what the significance of this for this chapter and the fact that Cyrus is reorganizing his empire, I was thinking, if you're going to take this approach, your administrators are going to have to administer differently than they did under the Babylonians and way different from they did under the Assyrians. But even under the Babylonians, this is a significant change. You can't use the goodwill of the Persians and have a nasty administration. You can't have your administration scheming and cheating and being corrupt and stealing from the local populations. You've got to have a whole different mindset. You've got to have a cleaner administration if it's all going to be built on goodwill. So what Cyrus is going to have to do in order to make this work is he's going to have a different mindset in his administrators. I was thinking about this several years back, 10, 15 years ago. I had, on two or three different occasions, I talked to administrators of schools that were starting up that used the classical education system. And one of the things that I found very interesting is a lot of these schools, they were trying to start up and they were trying to do classical education, but they were using teachers who had years of experience teaching. Usually it was in the public schools. Sometimes it was in private Christian schools. But the thing that was striking to me is classical education requires a different way of thinking about education in general. Because typically what teachers are taught in our time is that education is the transference of information. So they're taught to various techniques for helping students to assimilate and retain information. But what's required in classical education is that teachers not do that primarily. I mean, certainly that's always a part of education, but that's not primarily what a teacher does. Primarily what a teacher does is to help students learn the skills that are necessary to be able to think and to read and to write. And that's not just the transference of information. It's a different kind of activity. And what I found in talking to these administrators of classical schools is many of them were just putting different slogans in the classroom, using different curriculum, but they couldn't get their teachers to make this change in mindset that's necessary for real classical education to happen. And I thought that was really interesting. Those habits become deeply ingrained, and it's hard to change that. I would guess that Cyrus ran into that same problem. He's going to he's going to introduce this different way of thinking about empire. He can't use the administrators that were administering the Babylonian Empire because it was built on a different principle. The empire was divided into 120 districts with a satrap appointed over each district. So that's part of his reorganization. And there are going to be three individuals appointed over those satraps to keep them in line. And one of those was Daniel. And it says specifically that his job was to look out for the interests of the king. Baldwin says his intention in appointing overseers of his civil service is that the king suffer no loss, that is, in territory due to uprisings or in taxation due to graft. So that's Daniel's job. Daniel must have been particularly capable in this position. He was very successful, and the king planned to make him the overseer of the entire realm. It's interesting, the text says that the king planned to do this. We never have any indication that the king actually did it, so we don't know whether that happened or not, but that was the plan of the king. And that obviously aroused jealousy among the other administrators. Now, having thought about what's going on here, it seems to me that the overseers, the satraps, the other administrators, they are upset because it is completely changing the nature of their jobs. And most importantly, it's insisting on clean administrators. Administrators that are not corrupt, because corruption is going to undermine this system, unlike the Babylonian and the Assyrian system. The Babylonian and Assyrian system, they can both tolerate a certain amount of corruption on the part of administrators. But the Persian system, because it's being based on goodwill, developing goodwill, it can't take that. So they probably heard a system in which corruption was winked at and they could enrich themselves. But in this system, that's not going to be possible. And so it is someone exactly like Daniel that needs to be an overseer in order to root that out and keep that from happening. And I think that's why in the text it underscores the fact by stating it twice that Daniel was not corrupt and he was incorruptible. So the other administrators see him as an obstacle, a detriment to their livelihoods. They are not going to be able to make themselves rich under Daniel the way that they might have made themselves rich under the Babylonian system, for instance. So they're trying to think, okay, how are we going to get rid of Daniel? And the problem is, with respect to his responsibilities in the government, they can find no basis to get rid of him. So they're trying to think, is there anything else? And it would appear that they surveilled Daniel. They watched him to see what he did and where are some weaknesses that we might be able to exploit. And they couldn't find anything, because Daniel had so much integrity, they couldn't find anything. And they decided that the only opportunity that they might have to drive a wedge between Daniel and the emperor was to take advantage of the fact that Daniel was totally loyal to his God, to the God of Israel. And they saw that as an opportunity, because they could show, if they could find a way to show that since Daniel had a higher loyalty to God, his loyalty to the king was not complete. So that becomes their strategy. And complete loyalty to the empire is inherently attractive to the spirit of empire, I would argue. And the greater one's investment in empire, the greater the attraction this is. So these administrators, they're attracted to this solution. that you get rid of Daniel on the basis that he is not 100% loyal to the empire. But they're going to state it a little differently, not 100% loyal to the emperor. Let's look at the next section, verses 6 through 9. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, "O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. So this group, they say that it's royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors. They all have agreed. It's not clear how many people are involved in this, but they're making it sound like everybody in the administration agree that this would be a good law. So there are a number of administrators who have colluded to trap Daniel, and they're going to do it by a law that they have devised, which is very clever, because this law is going to appeal to the king's ego that no one can pray to anyone except the king for 30 days. And I'm sure what they're arguing is that this will contribute to the unity of empire. The whole empire will be unified around its prayers to the king. But it's only a temporary measure. It's only for 30 days. So it's not going to alienate people because they can't worship their gods again. But it's just for 30 days. But 30 days, their prayers will all be directed towards the emperor of the Persian Empire. And it flatters the king in that the king will be granted a kind of godlike status. The punishment that they decree for anyone who violates this is a severe one. Anyone who violates this would be thrown into the lion's den. We know historically that the Persian kings liked, as did Assyrian kings before them, and I assume the Babylonian kings as well, they liked to hunt lions as a sport, and showing their how skilled they were in warlike activities, and so they had lions, they had a collection of lions that could be used in these hunts. So in all likelihood, that Cyrus has a number of lions in a cage that can be let out periodically. One of them could be let out for him to hunt down. So the punishment for anyone who does not abide by this law is they will be thrown in to the lion's den and be eaten alive. They encourage the king to sign this quickly. You've got to sign it before you can read it, Emperor. They want him to sign it quickly because they don't want him to think twice about it. They wanted this encoded in law, and it was a saying among the Medes and Persians that a law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed. It's inalterable. So they want it signed as quickly as they can so that it is fixed. It's a done deal and they can get Daniel. They don't want him to think twice about this, because if he goes away and thinks about it, he might not sign it. Darius signs the law. Verses 10 through 15. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. 3 times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. And these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays 3 times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, "Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So Daniel had a habit of praying to Yahweh 3 times a day. He finds out about this new law that's been passed. So he knows what's going to happen. He knows he's going to get caught. And he knows that he's going to be thrown in the lion's den because of it. But he doesn't change his habits. He doesn't see that as a reason to do anything different than he has done for a very long time. We don't know how long, maybe the whole time that he's been in Babylon. In his house, he has windows facing Jerusalem. And he would pray on his knees facing towards the city of Jerusalem. Now, there's no commandment that requires this. No commandment in the Old Testament that requires a person to pray facing the temple in Jerusalem. But it is interesting. There are 3 passages where it talks about praying while facing the temple. All of them come from the speech that Solomon gave when he dedicated the temple, which is a great speech. There are 2 times in the King's passage where it mentions it, and 1 time in the Chronicles passage, all of them, though, referring back to that speech that Solomon made. I'll read the passage from 2 Chronicles 6, 28 to 31. It says, "When famine or plague comes to the land, or blight or mildew, locusts or grasshoppers, or when enemies besiege them in any of their cities, whatever disaster or disease may come, and when a prayer or plea is made by any of your people, Israel, each one aware of his afflictions and pains, and spreading out his hands towards this temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place. Forgive and deal with each man according to all he does, since you know in his heart, since you know his heart, for you alone know the hearts of men, so that they will fear you and walk in your ways all the time they live in the land you gave our fathers." So that's part of the speech that Solomon gave in the dedication of the temple, that when they are afflicted, they are to turn towards the temple and pray. So apparently, Daniel's aware of this passage and adopts this as his practice. It's never commanded, but it's referred to here, and apparently Daniel has adopted this practice. The part about 3 times a day, nowhere is this commanded. But there is reference to praying 3 times a day in Psalm 55, 16 through 19. And in this psalm, David is talking about the need for prayer in times of affliction. And he says, "But I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. God, who is enthroned forever, will hear them and afflict them. Selah. So both of these practices are just mentioned in the Old Testament. Both of them are prayer practices that are recommended, are mentioned in the context of affliction coming upon Israel. And Daniel adopts both of these as his regular practice. I think that's fascinating. And he will not vary from that. He could easily have decided, once that law was passed, he could easily have decided, I don't have to pray 3 times a day. I don't have to pray this 30 days. I don't have to pray in my looking out the window where I'm visible. I could back up 10 feet and be in my room where nobody can see me. He could have altered his practices and saved his life, but he didn't. These are practices, but they have significance to him beyond just the practices, and he doesn't alter them. So, as could be predicted, Daniel's adversaries caught him in the act. They sent a group to spy on Daniel so they'd have lots of witnesses. They had lots of witnesses. So they approached the king and in a very sneaky way. The first thing they do is they say, didn't you sign, seems to me, I have a vague recollection that you signed this law. Did you sign this law? And Darius said, yeah, I signed it. And something that becomes law is a signed law in our culture that cannot be revocated. So he has put himself into a trap. He walked right into a trap that was created for this particular purpose. So they say to him, they caught Daniel praying. And they referred to him as one of the exiles from Judah. This is the second time this phrase has been used. Belshazzar used that phrase in reference to Daniel. That's clearly, it has to be a derogatory expression. It has to have a negative connotation to it. So it's this exile from Judah that broke the law. And the way they say it is that he pays no attention to you. That is a gross exaggeration. Daniel pays attention to Cyrus. Obviously, he has respect for Cyrus and does what he's told to do. So to say that he pays no attention to Cyrus is such a gross overstatement, it's a lie. He does have a higher loyalty, but it's not the same as saying that he pays no attention to Cyrus. So they have implied that Daniel is an insubordinate. He's a rebel in their midst. And he violates the law 3 times a day. He does it often. The king hears this and he is very distressed because he got caught. He allowed Daniel to be caught up in this trap. He didn't see it coming. The king obviously cares deeply for Daniel. Clearly, the king cares deeply about Daniel. He spent all day, the text tells us, he spent all day trying to figure out how to get around this, how to spare Daniel. But he can't figure a way to get out of it. And just to make sure, Daniel's adversaries come back and remind the king, you can't violate the law. It is our principle, long-standing principle, that a law of the Medes and Persians cannot be abrogated. And I'm sure that they argued to ignore a law is to undermine all laws and the whole system will come down. So you can't make an exception for Daniel. Next section, verses 16 through 18. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. So the king orders that what the law called for is carried out, that Daniel be thrown into the lion's den. And that's what they did. They took him and they threw him in with the lions, and they sealed the opening. They sealed it with a stone, and then that is sealed with the king's ring and with the rings of his nobles. So a lot of people are all guaranteeing that this stone is in place and Daniel will not be, no one will be able to rescue him without it being clear that the law was broken, that they broke those seals. In parting, the king says to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." Which is, Cyrus is a very sympathetic character here. His love for Daniel is very clear. He likes everything about Daniel, including his devotion to his God. And he seems to be truly sorry that this has come to pass the way it's come to pass. The next section, verses 19 through 24. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So the king couldn't sleep all night. He's been worried about Daniel. So he gets up early and he goes to the lion's den to see what's happened. And he calls out to Daniel, refers to him as the servant of the living God. He says, "Was your God able to save you?" And Daniel responds, "Yes." He says, "O king, live forever." So there is clearly a mutual respect between Cyrus and Daniel. And Daniel says, "My God saved me. He sent an angel to muzzle the lions, because Daniel was innocent before God and Daniel was innocent before the king. He's innocent of all charges. So God saved Daniel." Now, I don't know why it is that Daniel could be removed from the lion's den at this point. Apparently, there were laws in the ancient Near East that if someone was tortured and survived for 24 hours, that they were to be released. Maybe there's something along those lines. I don't know. But in any case, having survived the night, Cyrus feels like he has carried out the law of the Medes and Persians and has Daniel taken out of the lion's den. And Daniel was untouched by them. Then he turns around and orders that all of these people who plotted to get Daniel killed, he has all of them thrown into the lion's den. Not only the plotters, but their families and their children all were thrown into the lion's den, and they were all killed. And the lions were obviously hungry. Even though they didn't touch Daniel, they went after the plotters. The next section, we have a marvelous decree by King Cyrus. Verses 25 to 27. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land. May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. An amazing decree on the part of a pagan king. It's issued to the entire empire. Every language, every people, language, and nation. We've seen that kind of phrasing used throughout the book of Daniel. There's this emphasis on uniting the whole empire. They're all included in this. He says, may you prosper greatly, or may your peace abound. And then he proclaims that everyone should show respect for the God of Daniel, because his kingdom is living and eternal. It will never be destroyed. He will rule forever. He saves. He performs signs in heaven and on earth. And we know that because he saved Daniel from the lions. An amazing speech. And one has to wonder, what is the true state of Cyrus's heart? And with Nebuchadnezzar, it's hard to know for sure what is the state of his real heart. Could it be that momentarily he is speaking better than he knows? And it's just hard to say. But at this point in time, Cyrus seems to understand who Yahweh is. And that's amazing. Last verse. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. I talked about this earlier. It appears that Cyrus and Darius are the same person, and that this verse is actually making that equation. But Daniel prospered. The very opposite of what the plotters had sought to have happen happens. There's a great inversion. The great inversion that Isaiah likes to talk about, where the oppressed, the downtrodden, will emerge triumphant. And that's what happens here. Daniel is being victimized by evil people. But in the end, Daniel comes out unscathed and even prospers. And those who are trying to victimize him are thrown into the lion's den and are killed. I like stories where the good guys win. I remember this story being one of my favorites when I was a child. It's just a great story. All right, I have a few comments about the chapter as a whole, and then I can open it up for questions. One of the things that struck me when I was looking at this, and commentators, a number of commentators mentioned this, that chapter 3 and chapter 6 are so similar. Remember, chapter 3 was when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were seen not bowing down to the statue. And so some jealous administrators told the king, told Nebuchadnezzar, that they hadn't bowed down the way Nebuchadnezzar had asked them to do. And So Nebuchadnezzar threw them into the furnace, and yet they came out. They were protected by God, and they came out unscathed. So the stories are similar in a number of respects. One of the commentators that I use is Joyce Baldwin. It's a very good commentary. She says, similarities between this chapter and chapter 3 include not only the general theme of God's deliverance from certain death, but also structure, style, and vocabulary. This is the same use of repetition effectively employed so that, for example, the thrice repeated refrain, the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked, anticipates the irony of verse 26, where the new decree effectively negates the object of the original decree of verse 7. There's also a certain overlap in vocabulary between the two chapters, illustrated by the word satrap, just cited, by dot decree, and by the idiom make a decree. So what Baldwin is saying is, you could argue, well, the reason that chapter 3 is so similar to chapter 6 is because the incidents themselves are very similar, which has, there's some truth to that. But Baldwin is saying, but the similarities go beyond just similar incidents. They're recorded in a similar way, same style, same vocabulary. The author is encouraging us to relate these two incidents. One possible answer to that question, why are these two so similar? Why did the author of the book record these in a way that they are so similar? One possible explanation for that is, I think, the idea of the continuity of empire. As I've said before, I think that the book of Daniel is about empire with a capital E. And in this situation, we have one empire, the Babylonian Empire, being replaced by the Persian Empire, a whole different empire. But as we can see from this incident, compared to chapter 3, more stayed the same than changed. It's a whole different people, whole different ruler, but there is a lot the same. The same things are happening. It seems to be the case that the tendency of sinful human beings is to gravitate towards empire. And that gravitation towards empire results in the persistence of empire, no matter who's in control, no matter what political changes take place. That impulse is still there, and it progresses whenever it can. In Solzhenitsyn's book, The Gulag Archipelago, which is actually it's a three-volume book, one of many great points that he makes in that book is that revolutions don't change much. And he's talking about the Russian Revolution. And that three-volume book, it's an odd genre. I don't know what you would even call it. He calls it a novel, but it's more like history than a novel. It's based on research that he did by talking to people in the camps and in the concentration camps, in the prison camps. But one of the things that he points out that is, if it weren't so terrible, it would be humorous, that before the revolution, the Tsar built some of these camps. And the main purpose for these camps was a place to send political prisoners, in particular revolutionaries, and in particular the group of revolutionaries that the Tsar was most concerned about and wanted to be confined were the social revolutionaries, the SRs. So he would arrest them and send them off to these camps, in Siberia. And these camps were heavily fortified and they were heavily guarded so that nobody could get out. After the revolution, Lenin takes control. And once Lenin gains control, the curious thing is the secret police, which were started by the Tsars. The Tsars had a secret police that would help find those revolutionaries and send them off to prison. What Lenin did was he discovered that there were people in Russia that didn't like the fact that the Bolsheviks had attained control. So they had political enemies. So he developed a secret police. And that secret police would go around finding rebels, revolutionaries, and ship them off to camps to keep them contained. What camps did they send them to? The same camps. The same camps that the Tsar had built. And who's guarding those camps? It's the same guards. Why were they guarding the camps? Because who's good at guarding the camp? It's the ones who have the experience and training to do it. And they found some who were out of work after the revolution and hired them to guard these camps. And who are the people in the camps? Well, they're the revolutionaries. What revolutionaries are they? Are they new revolutionaries? Some of them are, but most of them are the same old revolutionaries. Because they had been revolutionaries pushing for the revolution, but once the revolution happened, they weren't happy with the outcome. It didn't turn out the way they thought it would. It didn't bring heaven on earth like they thought it would. So they wanted more change. They didn't like Lenin's control because he was no longer moving in the direction that they thought he should move. So they end up being the ones that get arrested, and they end up in those camps. So before the revolution, you have the Tsar's camps guarded by the Tsar's guards who are guarding the rebels against the Tsar. After the revolution, you've got the Tsar's camps with the Tsar's guards guarding the people who were revolutionaries against the Tsar. Nothing changed. And that happens time and time again. I remember when we went into Iraq, the policy was that no one who worked for the state government in Iraq could serve in that function again. That was the rule at the beginning. But they had these problems. I remember one of them was the sewage treatment plant for Babylon broke down. Who's going to fix it? Who knows how to fix it? Well, it's the guy who was in charge of the sewage treatment plant before the revolution, before we came in. He happened to work can't remember the ruler's name, the guy who ruled Iraq, and therefore is technically not allowed to do it, but exceptions, our government started making exceptions so that people like him could serve in that capacity because there was nobody else to do it. And that happens time and time again. You can have these huge, what appear to be huge revolutions. But starting from the most mundane tasks within a society, it's the old people who come in and fill the old spots. And so at the end, it looks a lot like it did before. And that's Solzhenitsyn's point. So there is a lot of continuity in empire. You have a continuity of personnel that I'm talking about here, but you've also got the continuity of the spirit of empire that I have argued is in all of us. And given the chance, it wants to build empire. And those people that end up serving in the new administration, their interests are closely allied with the interests of empire with a capital E, as we see these people in chapter 6. They want the persistence of the Babylonian Empire. They want that order to continue to survive. So in both events, in both chapter 6 and in chapter 3, we have this nameless cadre of administrative personnel working to destroy Daniel and his friends. Because Daniel and his friends, they would undermine empire, and they are not in solidarity with the cadre. So empire takes on a life of its own. It establishes and cultivates its own personnel, its own institutions, its own specific laws, and over time those become ingrained, and society and the empire takes on a life of its own, such that everybody within that empire is to one degree or another victimized by it. So we have a situation here in which Cyrus is victimized by empire. The emperor is victimized by empire. Fascinating. However, one of the things that I think is particularly surprising in the book of Daniel is that we have within the ranks of the administrative personnel within the empire, Daniel and his friends keep finding some sympathetic people. Sometimes it's the emperor. We have that with Nebuchadnezzar. And we have that with Cyrus. Both of those emperors were sympathetic with Daniel and his friends. But we also saw it with Ashpenaz, who was the chief of the court officials. We saw it with the guard who was just under Ashpenaz that Daniel negotiated with to get the change in diet. All four of these characters within the book of Daniel are very sympathetic with Daniel and his friends, and they buffer Daniel and his friends from direct interaction with empire, and I think with the harshness of empire, and I think that's fascinating. God has created little niches within the empire where these men have a certain amount of protection. Okay, there are a couple other comments pertaining to this chapter that I'll talk about briefly. One is, Cyrus was victimized by the unintended consequences of the law. That was all staged, it was all contrived by the administrators, but they put him in a trap where he signed a law that had implications that he didn't envision. And I'll just point out, this is something that Edmund Burke talks about in his book, Reflections on the Revolution in France. He argues that you should never engage in a rapid, sweeping transformation of the laws in a society. Because that's what was happening in France. Because he's writing at the time of the French Revolution. And they're just throwing everything old out and starting from scratch. And Edmund Burke says, that's crazy. You're going to cause a humongous amount of pain and suffering. That's just crazy. Because in any complex system like a society, if you make big changes, nobody can predict all of the ways that's going to work itself out. And a lot of those are going to be bad. A lot of those unintended consequences are going to be bad. So what he argues is, don't do these wholesale changes, sweeping changes. Just make the change as small as is necessary to fix the problem that you see. And gradually work towards something that works better. But that way, you can see the changes, what changes take place as your system evolves, as you change your system over time, and stop it in places where it's causing negative impact. I think that's wonderful advice. I think that's a very interesting perspective. Darius Cyrus was victimized by signing into law one that he did not recognize the unintended consequences of it. The other thing I'd like to point out is, as I go through Daniel, I am more and more impressed with the person of Daniel. He is a remarkable man. He's extremely capable. He's incorruptible. He's unflappable. And he is totally devoted to God. And he's loyal to his people. He prayed faithfully for the forgiveness of Israel. We'll see more of this in chapter 9. I'm a little surprised, having thought about this a little bit, I'm surprised that there isn't more reference to Daniel in the Bible. It could be that there are more references than I'm aware of, than I recall. But he is an amazing figure in the Old Testament, certainly worthy of our admiration and our emulation. And something that I want to think about and explore a little bit more in my mind is, it seems to me that there are some hints that he is a Moses-like figure. And I'm going to be thinking about that before we get to chapter 9, because that's another place where the character of Daniel is very evident. We'll talk about that when we get there. Okay, those are my comments. Are there any questions? Sam Hobbs says, I don't suppose they have ever found archaeological remains of a lion's den in Babylon. I don't know whether they have or not. The way that we know that they had them and that the kings hunted lions is from the artwork, the engravings that were on the walls of the palaces at Nineveh in Assyria, but also on the walls of Babylon. I assume that they have, that there are similar ones in the walls of the capitals of Persia, but I don't know that for certain. But I know that there are literary references to the kings hunting lions. To my knowledge, no lion's den has been found, but I don't know for sure. Sam also asked, would the king's decree have been on clay tablets? That's another one I don't know. I would guess so. They start moving to papyrus. They start moving to both papyrus and vellum. They start using those in Judea at about this time. They're certainly using vellum. I'm pretty sure they're using papyrus at that time. But they also use clay shards. I don't know whether this law would have been written on clay tablets or whether it would have been written on something else. I don't know. Leslie Franks writes, who were the Medes? The Medes were a people group in the mountains, in the highlands of Iran. I've never been there. I've never seen it. But the way it's described to me is you have the Mesopotamian Valley, and the Tigris and Euphrates run through the Mesopotamia Valley. That's where Babylon was located. That's where Assyria was located. But as you go to the northeast from there, the terrain starts to go uphill. And there are these slopes that lead up to this high plateau, and Iran is on that high plateau. And there were two kingdoms that developed on that high plateau. To the southeast was the Persian kingdom, And to the northwest of that were the Medes. The Medes were historically the stronger of the two. And they were basically the fighting force for the Persian Empire. And their military ability was envied throughout the Middle East. Interestingly, I don't know if this is true, but interestingly, the Kurds who live in northern Iraq, they claim to be the descendants of the Medes. I don't know that that's true, but that's their tradition. That's what they believe to be true. Denise says, would those murals be at the British Museum in London? Amazing carvings of lion hunting and chariots. I know that the Assyrian engravings are at the British Museum. Interestingly, if you want to see them, in the Gutenberg Library, there is a book of the Assyrian engravings from the British Museum. Very good, very high quality photographs, and you can look through those, and they're great. That's a great book, so you can see those. But yes, they're in the British Museum. The stuff from Babylon, I think, is in the museum in Berlin. I don't know if it's all there, but I know a lot of it is there. Yeah, you say from Babylonian times. Yes, that's in, if I'm correct, that's in Berlin. Katie Rhodes says, any signs of empire today? Absolutely. If you're talking about empire with a capital E, the way I've been using it, societies, general drift, the tendency, because of the spirit of empire within all of us, that drives any society in the direction of developing empire. At least that's what I would argue, and I think that's the biblical perspective. And so the signs of empire are all around us. I mean that desire to unite a whole group of different peoples together behind the goal of developing the prosperity of that empire, the power and prosperity of that empire, so that we can all be secure. That force is at work in any society. How fast it moves in that direction depends on the degree to which there is any resistance to that drift, and the degree to which that society has the means to bring it about. I would argue that we have developed the technology to achieve more of the goals of empire with a capital E in our time than existed, say, in the time of Babylon. The desire is no greater now than it was in ancient times, but the ability to get there has become greater. And so that force is at work and developing, and I'd say we've got empires. We've got societies working towards empire all over the world. And Denise says, it's an amazing display. Oh. And I suspect you're talking about the one at the British Museum. You've probably seen it. Yes. Both the Babylonian engravings and the Assyrian engravings are phenomenal. I'm sure you could find them online. I'm sure that there are images online. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention. We'll move on to chapter 7 next week. Chapter 7, as I've mentioned before, it's a change in genre. We're at a pivotal point in the book, and we'll have to talk about why that is and what's happening. But we'll tackle that next week. Thanks. Bye, all.